Okay, so I just want to talk briefly about, I'm going to say enough to decide the issue about this proposal. It seems like something like this proposal ought to be viable. So the proposal being roughly that where you have things like the T schema applying to sentences, so S is true if and only if S, for example, you really need to add in some condition to the effect that S expresses a proposition. So this is something like, if sentence S expresses a proposition, then S is true if and only if S. Or you know, simply move to a propositional version of the relevant schema. So you might think, you know, this is one of the benefits of a particular way of pursuing the notion of truth that we saw in the minimalist program, right, Horowitz's minimalist program. The idea there is that truth applies fundamentally and gets its nature from its application to propositions. And then the idea will be that with respect to these, what Horowitz would call pathological cases, right, the psychotic sentences, right, like the liar sentence, what we should say is that those sentences fail to express a proposition. Okay. So I think, yeah, something to that idea. But there are going to be some problems that need to be overcome before it can be ultimately accepted. So one kind of problem is, I don't know that he emphasises it in exactly this context, but he emphasises the fact about liar cases. The problem emphasised by Kripke is that whether a sentence is liar susceptible, whether a sentence is in the relevant sense pathological, often depends on highly contingent features of the situation in which the assessments to take place. And we saw an aspect of this in effect when I set up the first version of the lie, the Cretan version, where we had to make various background assumptions about what happened before in order to make this particular target example problematic. But the issue is entirely general. So here's kind of case, just to see how one could generate cases of this sort in a fairly systematic way. Suppose that I'd left the following sentence up on the board in my room, S2.53. There's a philosophy class here now. Okay, it's left that on my board. And now I write in here, sentence one is true and sentence two is false. And that's sentence two, so it makes reference to itself. So if, as I believe to be so, there's no philosophy class now going on in my office, then 2 just comes out straightforwardly false due to the falsity of its first conjunct, right? That sentence is true. But if through some emergency, Sarah in the office has been forced to make use of my office for a philosophy class, sentence 2 becomes paradoxical. First component comes out true, and so the assessment of the sentence as a whole turns on whether the sentence as a whole is false, right? And thus generates a paradox. And this is entirely general, right? And one can easily see how to go about generating further cases of this kind, where whether this particular sentence is paradoxical turns on these extrinsic contingent facts. But now the proposal was that to deal with examples of paradox, this kind, semantical paradox, liar paradox, what we want to say is that the target sentence fails to express a proposition. So on the no proposition view, that means that we'd be apt to suffer from what we can think of as illusions of understanding, right? So we take ourselves to grasp a proposition expressed by the target liar sentence, but there's no such proposition. And that's especially pressing in this kind of case. So we've got the target. If there's no class in my office right now, the sentence just comes out false. That seems fine. So it expresses a proposition, comes out false. If there's a class in my office right now, the thing comes out paradox-friendly, so we ought to say it fails to express a proposition. Right? So whether this form of words expresses a proposition at all or not depends on what's going on in my office right now. it's going to seem to me, perhaps, that it expresses a proposition in either case. Right? It's going to seem the same to me, whatever's going on in my office. I might be entirely convinced that there's no class going on in my office. If I'm wrong about that, it's going to seem to me as though my claim expresses a proposition and comes out false. But because I'm wrong, in fact, what I've said, the form of words I've used has entirely failed to express a proposition, right, on this kind of view. And more generally, right, it's going to have to amount to a kind of discovery that in certain cases, a sentence fails to express a proposition. Right? You see the sentence, it looks okay, you think you can understand it, so you start thinking about whether it's true or false. Right? So you think you've grasped the proposition the thing expresses, you think, I wonder whether that proposition is true or false. You begin the program of trying to assess the sentence, during which procedure you discover that there's no admissible answer to the question whether the sentence is true or false. Try saying it's true and it comes out false. You try saying it's false and it comes out true and so forth. And you flip-flop, yeah.
So in this context, is a proposition just the thing that is expressed in the sentence that is capable of being true or false?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the idea. So we're assuming that propositions are truth-bearers. They're the kinds of things that are true or false, and then somehow the sentence manages to express one of those things, or not. Right? So there are going to be easy cases where we don't express a proposition. So I go, fleur, 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 fleur. Right? Fail to express a proposition. Okay? Was what I just said true or false? No. Right? Well, I mean, it certainly wasn't true. Okay? But not because it was false, because I didn't say anything. I failed to express a proposition. So there'll be clear cases like that, but the proposal is that roughly we should model the liar on that kind of case. It's not saying we can't do that, but we need to be aware of the costs and the need to say a bit more about why no proposition gets expressed and what we should say about what's going on given that no proposition gets expressed. Okay, so what we get is that whether or not a sentence is a truth value gap in the required sense depends upon these, in many cases, contingent features of the context of utterance and can't be predicted just from the form of the sentence. So as I've said, right, to establish whether a sentence expresses a proposition becomes, you know, part of the procedure of trying to establish whether the thing is true or false. The procedure one's going through in trying to find out, in effect, whether what one's got is pathological. So, to establish whether we're dealing with a truth value gap in this sense, something that fails to express a proposition, we first have to begin trying to assess the truth value of the sentence. So we make use of the meanings of the words in the sentence and the way they're put together as the basis for an attempt to try and figure out whether this sentence is true or false. We begin the procedure. But now look, if we can begin to assess the truth value of the sentence, right, the sentence tells us enough to begin the procedure of figuring out whether the sentence is true or false. We grasp enough of its meaning for that. It's not obvious how we're to understand the idea that the sentence doesn't determine, lacks a truth value. Right? So what you want is a procedure that's determined enough that, you know, you understand the sentence, that puts you in the market for running through a procedure in an attempt to determine what the truth value of the sentence is. But it doesn't do enough to fix a determinate outcome to the pursuit of that procedure. Right? It doesn't do enough to fix that this sentence expresses a proposition that itself determinately fixes itself as true or false. Slightly more generally, we need the idea that it's possible to have some kind of determinate understanding of a sentence, some grasp of its meaning, that isn't yet enough to count as grasping a proposition that it expresses. So at least in some of these cases, perhaps all of them, will need a distinction between the meaning of a sentence and proposition it expresses. Right? Because if we want to try saying that these sentences are meaningless, that's going to be even more puzzling. Right? Liar sentences claim to be meaningless. How can it be then that we can figure out that it gives us enough information to figure out that it's paradoxical? It's only in the course of following through something like instructions embodied in the meanings of the words employed in the sentence that we discover that there's no determinate assignment of truth value to the sentence. Okay. So we need the idea that you can grasp enough of the thing's meaning to figure out that it's truth valueless, right? To figure out that it leads you into trouble, but not enough for that grasp of meaning to fix a particular proposition that the thing expresses. We might worry that it's not clear how to make sense of that kind of position. We might think we need to say a bit more about what the position looks like. Consider also this kind of pair of cases. Got sentences like 1 and 2. Sentence 1 says sentence 1 is not true. Right? We know that that's paradox friendly. So that sentence there, on this kind of view, is truth valueless and doesn't, you know, because it fails to express a proposition. Sentence 2 just says sentence 1 is not true. Okay. Now we might allow that one is a truth value gap due to its paradoxical nature, right? Fails to express a proposition. That's the kind of response we're considering. But there appears on the face of it to be absolutely nothing at all wrong with two, right? Indeed, two seems to partly express the theory that we're currently considering, according to which one is a truth value gap, right? So two seems to say something perfectly kosher. But we might worry about that, given, again, the kind of superficial similarity between what these sentences are up to. Right? You might wonder how this one can be entirely devoid of the power to express a proposition, given its similarity with this one, which not only expresses a proposition, but comes out straightforwardly true. Okay. Not only do these sentences look similar, we might think that two says, right, expresses a proposition to the effect, is exactly what one would say if it weren't paradoxical. Right? So in that case, it looks like we know enough about one to know precisely what proposition, right, or close to what proposition it would express if only it expressed the proposition. Okay, and again, we might find that puzzling. How can the meaning of this sentence do enough not only to get us started on looking for the relevant proposition, but seemingly do enough to tell us what the proposition this would express if only it's expressing that proposition didn't lead us into trouble? And we might think that that's at least minimally mysterious. The final issue here is, I mean, I think there are going to be ways past this, but just it's worth thinking about how one would deal with this kind of problem. Need to deal with versions of the strengthened liar designed to target this style of view. So you want to consider cases a bit like this. This sentence is false or fails to express a proposition, right? And then you want to consider how you'd go about assessing this kind of sentence with respect to the issues we've considered. I think minimally work would be required to see whether or not this is a serious issue. I think there are probably fairly straightforward ways of dealing with this kind of case from the perspective of a no proposition view. The more pressing issues here are going to be finding a way of explaining why the target sentences fail to express a proposition, and then convincing people that view is acceptable, right? Thereby convincing them that it's okay to have a view on which people are widely subject, in principle, to illusions that they've grasped the proposition expressed by target sentences. Okay, so And there's work to be done to develop and defend the no propositions view, but it's got legs and it's worth pursuing, I think. You know, so one thing to think about here would be, with respect to the illusions of understanding issue, whether there are a kind of analogous cases, not paradoxical cases, but cases from other areas where it's reasonable to think you can kind of understand a sentence, right? You can grasp the meaning of a sentence, even take yourself to grasp a proposition expressed by the sentence, and yet to be wrong about that second bit, to be wrong that you've really grasped a proposition expressed by the sentence. So whether there are cases from other areas that can be used to kind of bolster this idea, the idea that, you know, there's enough in the meaning to begin trying to assess whether what's said is true or false. But when one reflects on the circumstances, one realises that ultimately nothing's been said. Right? Given that you think that truth really applies to things said rather than to sentences and their meanings, and see why in these cases one would get a kind of truth value gap. But that's a point where more work would be required. Okay, so very briefly, just to end talking about the liar, just to note that there are, I mean, as some of you know, because I know some of you pursued some of the literature in this area in writing your essays, there are a huge number of other approaches to dealing with the liar paradox, right? This is one of those areas, I mean, just like other areas of philosophy, where a problem generates an enormous variety, plurality of attempted solutions. Two elements we've pretty much assumed that have been directly targeted by some of these approaches are bivalence, the claim that all sentences are either true or false, and also non-contradiction, that we haven't really talked that much about. This is the claim that no sentence is both true and false at the same time. And one reason we've kind of held these ideas fixed, as I've tried to stress, is that both of these kinds of principles are pretty central elements of classical logic, right? And so, you know, insofar as it's as classical logic is kind of well ensconced as a standard way of approaching issues of this kind, it would seem to be fairly radical to consider revising our conception at these points. But in the face of issues like the liar paradox and other related issues, some theorists have considered giving up one or both of these principles, at least amending our understanding of how they apply. And one case in particular would be a denial of non-contradiction. What you tend to get here are views called paraconsistent logics. Okay, so these are ideas that allow for inconsistencies of certain kinds, or so-called dialetheist logics. Again, logics that allow for some sentences to be what are sometimes called truth value gluts. Okay, so what we've talked about to this point is truth value gaps, so cases where something lacks a truth value. It's a gap between the true and the false. The idea in paraconsistent logic is to allow for truth value gluts, where something has both values at the same time. Right? It's a symmetrical idea to the idea that something might lack a truth value. And one of the issues here is how to make sense of the very idea of a truth value glut. The main proponent of this kind of view is a philosopher called Graham Priest. Okay, he's an arch defender of this kind of view. Defends against all comers the idea that there can be such truth value gluts. One issue here is to prevent the explosion property of classical logic. Right? In classical logic, if you get a contradiction, if you end up in a position where you seem forced to endorse a contradiction, absolutely everything follows. Typical proponents of paraconsistent logics want to avoid that. Right? There's, as far as I know, one, maybe fewer, people who want to endorse what's called trivialism. Right, the extreme version of this view that everything's true. Okay, there are no falsehoods. Right? Well, there are falsehoods because that's another truth. I mean, this is an interesting idea, and it's worth pursuing, but I kind of think of it as just a sign of how stuck one can get in trying to deal with liar paradox, by how desperate one can become. Difficulty here, though, is in assessing this kind of view, because it turns out if you're willing to accept contradictions, then you're quite a tricky customer to argue with. Right? Usually, right, if you're in an argument with someone who won't accept contradictions, the best way of winning that argument is to force them in, to show them that their view leads to a contradiction. But these guys like that. And they just go, yeah, what follows? So it's difficult, and if you read any of the material, I recommend Graham Priest's work in this area. It's fun, it's interesting. But one of the things you'll see is it's actually fairly easy in many cases for Priest to win arguments, right? Because it's very difficult. I mean, how would you force this character to concede? Okay, because right, he would concede if you force trivialism on him, I think, but you can't do that because he doesn't think that everything follows from a contradiction. He'll just stop at a contradiction. So that's one way you might consider going. You might consider allowing for truth value gluts. Another way of going would be a kind of denial of bivalence. And here I'm thinking of the kind of denial of bivalence associated in particular with systems like intuitionistic logic. Because the difficulty here is that if you say that bivalence is false, then fairly straightforwardly, you don't even need full classical logic, fairly straightforwardly, on you know fairly minimal assumptions, that will lead to endorsing contradictions. So instead of saying that bivalence is false, what the intuitionistic logician does is refuse to affirm that it's true. Okay, and that gets them out of a fair amount of trouble. So the idea here is that some claims are in some sense neither true nor false without it being false that they're true and false that they're false, which would lead to contradiction. So the idea is that there's an indeterminacy of a certain kind, things that fail to be determined yet and perhaps ever as either true or false. Not saying they're not true, because that would be to suggest that it had been determined that they're not true. Okay, it's just indeterminate. So this kind of view, most interestingly associated in philosophy with Michael Dummett, is associated with the idea that Dummett calls anti-realism. Right? So the idea is that realism is a commitment to a strong form of bivalence. Every claim you could make about the universe is either true or false, right? It's fixed by the facts. Whereas Dummett's anti-realist response is that that's actually only true. That kind of claim only holds for those tracts of reality where we have a procedure for determining whether the claims are true or false. Yeah.
Sorry, just to understand, they're saying bivalence isn't true, but they're not saying bivalence is false, they're just denying it's true.
They're refusing to assert it. They don't want to say it's false.
Right.
So they're just
kind of being inconsistent with what they're
saying. Exactly. It's just kind of indeterminate, right? I mean, it's another form of indeterminacy.
So their own principle is itself indeterminate.
In a sense, yeah. I mean, it'll depend. I mean, what you get here is a formalism, which is just a different form of logic. And then there'll be different ways for different philosophers to understand it. Dummett's, I think, is in many ways the most interesting, where the idea is that things haven't yet been fixed, so to speak. You might think, you know, you can think in general of things like Aristotle's sea battle, right? So if you think that the future's open, right, you might think that right now it's neither true that I'm going to go to London tomorrow, have a sea battle, or false, right? Just hasn't been decided. Right? That's not to say, right? So it's kind of a refusal to say it's either one way or the other now. I'll go to London. Okay, so one motive for rejecting bivalence or refusing to affirm bivalence has been this issue about certain kinds of facts being beyond our ken, and the idea of not wanting to commit to the idea that even though we don't even know how to go about deciding the truth value of these claims, nonetheless, they're either determinedly true or determinedly false. slightly more generally, and this is the way that Dummett pushes that issue, the idea is that the motive for rejecting bivalence has been reflection on cases where our use or understanding of bits of language doesn't do enough to determine a truth value for all circumstances. Right, so the idea here is that the best we can do in our use of language and in making judgments is to latch on to propositions that fail to fully carve up reality into the cases where it would come out true and the cases where it would come out false. But a particular kind of case that's apt to look like this, the case I want to move on to now, is a case of vagueness. In particular, the assessment of particular kinds of what are called borderline cases of vagueness. So cases, I don't know, it's not a very good case, but suppose you think that it's indeterminate whether my shirt is grey or blue. Right? It's kind of, is it grey? I don't know. Is it blue? I don't know. And you kind of think, perhaps it's just not fixed that it's one way or the other. Okay? It's an intervening weird case. Again, that kind of case, you might think, is a case where your understanding of the meaning of grey fails to fix the determinate answer to the question, is my shirt grey or not grey? Okay, it's a kind of truth value gap in that sense. And we'll have a look at, we won't have a look at intuitionistic versions of that, but we'll have a look at views now that target this issue. Okay, so this is moving on to vagueness and the so-called sorites paradox. This is one of the people who will play a role here. This is Kit Fine, who will come to, proponent of one important view about vagueness. So, sorites derives from this expression, sorites, a label, it's used as a label for a variety of these kinds of puzzles, but it derives from the Greek for heap. And it's used as a label for various arguments of broadly the following form. Okay, so here's a kind of sorites-style argument. It's a bit like a slippery slope argument, the kind of thing that non-philosophers like to try and exploit in arguments. Premise one says that one grain of sand doesn't make a heap. Okay, and that seems plausible enough. Premise two just says, for any number of grains of sand you like, if exactly that number doesn't make a heap, then adding one more grain won't turn the non-heap into a heap. Okay, so for all numbers, if that number of grains of sand don't make a heap, then that number plus one grains of sand don't make a heap. Okay. But it follows from application of that second premise to the first premise that 10,000 grains of sand don't make a heap. And indeed, 10 million grains of sand don't make a heap. So you've got premise one looks true, premise two looks true, looks plausible that you can't turn a non-heap into a heap just by adding a grain of sand, and yet the conclusion, applications of P2, looks obviously false, looks like a denial that there are any heaps, which looks silly. Okay, so repeated applications of the second premise, we get one grain of sand doesn't make a heap, two grains of sand doesn't make a heap, three grains of sand doesn't make a heap, and so forth. We can just keep on going forever. So it turns out however much sand you have, you don't have a heap of sand. So starting with seemingly plausible premises and seemingly impeccable forms of reasoning, we arrive at a seemingly implausible and unacceptable conclusion that a huge quantity of sand doesn't make a heap. So what does that make this argument? It's a pop quiz. Oh, come on. Good, thank you. Help me out. It's near the end of term. This makes it a paradox. So as usual, the options are the following, right? Option one, deny at least one of the premises of the argument. Two, reject the forms of reasoning used to derive the conclusion. Or third, accept the conclusion. Right? So we either reject premise one or two, or accept that there are no heaps.
Okay.
And so forth, right, for every case where an argument of this form can be constructed, and that might be quite generally. And as usual, we'd like a justified assignment of blame. Right? We'd like not only to say, can we just drop premise one? I would like some reason for dropping premise one rather than dropping premise two, for example, or accepting the conclusion. And ultimately, it would be nice if we had some account of how we're tricked into accepting the premise that we're being invited to give up. Why does it even seem plausible that there are heaps, for example, if that's what you want to deny? Now, it seemed to most philosophers, obviously not all, that the crucial premise here is the second premise, the one that says just adding one grain of sand can't make the difference. And this is sometimes, perhaps usually, called a tolerance principle. So the idea is that some predicates, for example, predicate heap, tolerate small changes in the things that they apply to or fail to apply to. Right? So if something's a heap, then making a very small change to that thing won't change it into a non-heap. If something's a non-heap, then making a very small change to it won't turn it into a heap. So the expression heap is tolerant in this kind of way. And given that's a crucial premise, it would be natural to consider whether we can give that premise up. Natural kind of way of trying to respond to the paradox. So surely here we think mere addition of a single grain of sand can't make the difference between something that's a heap and something that's not a heap. Right? And that general thought is just a tolerance principle. It can never make a difference that you simply add one grain of sand. Let me just give a couple of examples other than the heap to see cases where this is kind of even more plausible, I guess. I think it's even more plausible. So suppose we have a vat of yellow paint, holds 1 million gallons, let's say, of yellow paint. And suppose that we now add a single drop, a tiny little drop of red paint, and stir the big vat. Surely that drop of red paint hasn't made the paint in the vat cease to be yellow, right? Seems right. Okay, so suppose we now add another single drop of red paint and stir. Surely the second drop of red paint hasn't made the paint in the vat cease to be yellow. Okay. Now, generalising from those fairly easy cases, it's at least plausible that it's difficult to see how the mere addition of such a drop of paint could ever take you from yellow paint to non-yellow paint. It's hard to see how this single drop could ever turn that trick. You might wonder how it could be, right, that any such single drop could have such a dramatic effect on the colour of the paint in the vat. But of course we can't, right, so that's the tolerance principle, but now if we accept that, which it's hard to resist, we're in the market for a Sorites argument in applications in this case. So we agreed that one drop of red paint doesn't make the paint non-yellow. But we also were inclined to accept that if n drops of paint don't make the paint non-yellow, then adding one more drop won't make the difference. But now it will follow by repeated applications of that second premise, the tolerance principle, that there's no quantity of red paint that would make the paint non-yellow. Right, so however much, right, starting with 1 million gallons of yellow paint, you end up, right, it takes a while, but drop by drop, you add in 20 million gallons of red paint. No difference, it's still yellow. And that looks unacceptable, looks implausible. Okay, so it's just another instance of Sorites' reasoning. Fairly easy to generalise. Let's take an even more extreme case. With each drop of paint added to the vat, we paint a stretch of a wall with the resulting mix of paint. So we paint some, you know, decent portion of some very big wall, say the Great Wall of China, and we continue doing this until the wall looks yellow at one end and red at the other. Okay. Got this very long expanse of paint. Since the paint's changed colour, as we assume it must, the wall changes colour from one end to the other. So we suppose the wall's about, you know, 5,500 miles long. And now we view the first yellow section of the wall through a hole in a large piece of card, say a hole about an inch in diameter, with a kind of wire cutting through the middle of the hole. And we're asked to compare the colour of the paint on one side of the wire with the colour of the paint on the other side of the wire. And naturally enough, we think that there's no discernible difference. So we move the card half an inch along and do the same thing again. Think again, doesn't make any difference. There's no difference from one side of the card to the other. So the first half of the first viewing looks yellow. For all viewings, if the first half looks yellow, then the second half doesn't look non-yellow. Seems right. But again, by repeated applications of that principle, we get that the second half of the last viewing looks yellow. Even though, by assumption, setting up the case, last viewing, like 5,500 miles down the wall, is stark red. So, first premise again looks plausible, as does the second, but the conclusion appears extremely implausible. Right? There are no such red walls. Again, we think something must have gone wrong. The philosophical question is, well, what exactly? What exactly should we do in response to this kind of paradox? So I'm going to call concepts and predicates that are seriati susceptible in this way vague concepts and predicates, kind of stipulative definition of what it is for something to be vague. And it should be clear, although, you know, I've given some specialist kind of examples, it should be clear that vagueness is rife. Very many of our concepts and predicates appear to be in some way tolerant, and so to be susceptible to at least the appearance that this style of reasoning is going to work out for them. You know, things like person, right? There are people who will try and argue that there aren't any persons by exploiting this style of reasoning. Because you take, you know, one particle away from a person, you don't get a non-person. So forth, going the other direction. Okay, so I've said in effect that the natural place to try and assign blame here isn't either end of the paradox, right? We think some things are clearly yellow, some things are clearly non-heaps, we think some other things are clearly heaps, some other things are clearly non-yellow. So the obvious place to try and assign blame is the tolerance principle. However, if we deny the heap tolerance principle, we get the following negation of that tolerance principle. It's not the case that for all numbers n, if n grains of sand don't make a heap, then n plus 1 grains of sand do not make a heap. It's a denial of the tolerance principle. But that denial in straight classical logic is equivalent to the following existential claim. There exists a number n such that n grains of sand do not make a heap and n plus 1 grains of sand do make a heap. Right? So there exists a particular number of grains of sand such that if you're at that number you're a non-heap, but if you just pop on one more grain of sand you have a heap. Right? Some number. Suppose it's 372 grains or something. And that seems hard to stomach. So straight denial of the tolerance principle appears to lead to straight assertion of the existence of what are called sharp cutoff points, right? Absolutely sharp cutoff points. They have to be absolutely sharp because otherwise they'll be vague, and then they'll be seriati susceptible. Okay? Similarly for the other cases we considered. Right? As long as we're dealing with drops of paint, there'll be a particular number of drops of red paint into the yellow vat, at which the thing goes from yellow to non-yellow. and so forth for all such cases. So this is Act Strike, Strikers is implausible. So this flat denial of the tolerance principle and so this endorsement of sharp cutoff points is apt to strike people as highly implausible. In particular, we're apt to think that we'd be at a loss to locate the point at which things change. No clue what number of grains of sand constitute a heap as opposed to a non-heap. Moreover, I don't have a clue how to go about finding out, right? There are plenty of things I don't know where I have at least an inkling about how to find out the thing I don't know, right? Like go to the library, Google or something. But I don't have any confidence at all in the idea that Googling how many grains of sand are required in order to just have a heap will have, you know, I'm sure there'll be answers online, but I'm not going to be convinced by any of those answers. So the question is, what right, in that case, do we have to assert that there is such a point? I don't have any clue where the point is or how to go about finding out where the point is. So with what right can I assert that for all that, I think there is one absolutely sharp cut-off point? So slightly more minimally, seems that we should accept, I think, at least for the run of these cases, at least it's plausible that we should accept that we don't know and cannot know, or at least don't have a clue how we can come to know, where, if anywhere, the precise or sharp cut-off points are. Okay? And the question now is, how exactly should we explain this seemingly principled ignorance? Right? So the minimal phenomenology here is, just don't have a clue. Right? Now we need to explain how it's possible for us not to have a clue. I mean, it fits what I was saying earlier about bivalence in that it's natural to think that if there's a sharp cutoff point between heaps and non-heaps, it surely must be fixed by the meaning of the expression heap, right? And it's natural to think that the meaning of the expression heap has to be fixed by something like my understanding of that expression, or my use of that expression, or our use of that expression. Right? But how, given that none of us has the foggiest idea, right, how to figure out where the line is, could our usage of this expression somehow conspire to fix a determinate cutoff point between the heaps and the non-heaps? How? That's the kind of underlying puzzle here. Until recently, the predominant account of our ignorance in this area has been based on the idea that the reason we don't know is because there's nothing to know, right? There's no fact of the matter. If you're going to know something, there has to be a fact, and there is no fact. It's just not fixed what the cutoff point is, so that there's a cutoff point. There's no fact of the matter about where the cutoff points are. So accordingly, on this kind of view, we need a way of denying that there are no sharp cut-off points, because that would lead us into the sororities, without thereby asserting that there are sharp cut-off points. Right? It's a fact of the matter that there's a sharp cut-off point. We need some way of understanding this kind of vague talk about there being no fact of the matter that would enable there to be no fact of the matter in such a way as to resolve the puzzle. So the idea here, as I've said, is that our concepts and predicates fail to determine answers to every question about their application. I fail to fix exactly classification of cases into the cases where the predicate clearly applies and the cases where it doesn't. Heaps, non-heaps, weird penumbral gap in the middle where there's no fact of the matter. Okay? In some cases, our concepts somehow, our meanings somehow, leave open whether or not they apply. So where this happens, we get what's known as a borderline case. A case where we're unwilling to apply a concept, right? We at least have some reticence about whether our concept applies. And we're also unwilling to apply a negation of the concept. Right? It's kind of what I said about my shirt with respect to being grey. Right? Some inclinations say, yeah, maybe it's grey, and some inclinations say, maybe not, but no kind of, it's not obvious which one should do, and so one's kind of stuck in a quandary, unwilling determinately to apply or withhold application of the concept. So semantic accounts, broadly construed, treat such borderline cases as cases where the concept doesn't apply and also doesn't not apply. So again, they try and make space for this kind of no fact of the matter, grey zone. And these kinds of accounts are called semantic accounts, since they trace our ignorance to the fact that our concepts or meanings fail to fix a fact to be known. Right? If there's no fact, there's no fact to be known, so no knowledge. That's why you're ignorant. Right? Insofar as you're even puzzled about this, it's because you kind of expect to be able to know this stuff. And that expectation is let down by the powers that your concepts and meanings have. So until recently, as I've said, that's been the predominant kind of account. I'm going to look in a bit, in some more detail, next time, at one such account. Before we do that, I want to mention a more recent account that attempts to deal with these cases in a slightly different way. And this is the so-called epistemic account. So according to this second sort of account, there are, in fact, absolutely determinate and sharp cut-off points. And so the reason for our ignorance of where those cut-off points lie has to be something other than the absence of a fact of the matter about where the cut-off points are. There are facts of the matter about this. There really is some number that you've got a non-heap with exactly that number of grains of sand, and you add one grain and acquire a heap. So ignorance on this kind of view is going to be explained in some other way, plausibly by some kind of general limits to what we can know in particular cases. In particular, something about our limited powers of discrimination, something. It's going to need careful handling, right, to avoid the possibility of our improving our powers of finding out where the cutoff points lie. If we want to defend the idea that there's just no way of finding out where the cutoff points lie, we'll talk more about that when we get to it. So this view is typically called an epistemic account, or an epistemicist account, if you like, because it traces our ignorance to aspects of our epistemic powers, our powers to know things, rather than tracing our ignorance to a kind of absence or problem in reality, or with respect to the meanings of our words or concepts. In at least one respect, the epistemic account is more modest than the semantic account, the semantic style of account that we started with, because it rests with what everyone agrees to, right, which is that we don't know. Right? It's kind of minimal starting point that we don't know where the sharp cutoff points are. The epistemic account says that's all there is to say, really. I mean, we can try and explain why you don't know, but the minimal fact here is you just don't know. By contrast, the semantic account is immodest here because it says not only that you don't know, but moreover has a further commitment about how things in fact are. Right? The reason you don't know is because of this fact about reality that there's no fact of the matter. So it goes beyond the minimal starting point and is therefore less modest than the epistemicist account. But in another respect, the epistemic account's less modest than the semantic account. It goes beyond what we minimally agree to, right, the starting point that we don't have a clue, right, we don't know where the cutoff points are, because it asserts that nevertheless there is an absolutely determinate sharp cutoff point with respect to each of these sorority's susceptible concepts. And so any such case, any case of vagueness, this is a matter of our ignorance, right? There's always a single answer, a determinate answer to the question, where do things go from yellow to red or what have you, person to non-person. Okay, I'm going to talk more about both styles of account next time. I'll give you some particular examples, talk about some of their strengths and weaknesses. Thank you.